Grunge is a good look for you.
Did you have a rough day, Agent Fury?
I'm gonna need clarification on this space invasion.
Skrulls are infiltrating your planet. They're shapeshifters.
Okay.
Prove you're not a Skrull.
That's a photon blast.
And?
A Skrull cannot do that.
I'm just supposed to take your word for that.
We are Kree. Strong. United. You have to let go of the past.
I don't remember my past.
Control it.
I have this power, but I don't know where it came from.
I've never seen anything like her.
You think you can find others?
She's just the beginning.
You've come a long way.
But you're not as strong as you think.
What is this?
The SHIELD logo.
Does announcing your identity on clothing help with the covert part of your job?
Said the space soldier who was wearing a rubber suit.
Get tickets now.
White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 389.
It's the Avengers Assemble podcast from the Jarvis Heads of AvengersAssemble.net. Now, here's your host, Van Allen Plexico.
Hello, and welcome to the Avengers Assemble podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment, in association with all of our great supporters via Patreon.com. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined for this special movie review episode, we only get two or three of these a year, by my longtime occasional co-host, Jim Yelton. Welcome aboard, Jim.
Hey, Van. Thanks for having me.
Well, we always got to talk when something big happens in the old MCU, and something big has happened. We've gotten the Captain Marvel movie finally. Honest to goodness, I felt like the build-up for this movie has gone on longer than any other Marvel movie I can think of. I've been seeing ads for this movie, I feel like, for a year. And it felt like it should have come out 6 months ago based on how long the ads. Maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just my anticipation because the other movie I felt that way about was Ready Player One. I felt like the build-up for that one went on for months and months and months and months. So maybe it's just me, because those are both two of the most anticipated movies in my life. And so we're here to talk about how we each saw it, and I have no idea. You haven't really dropped any hints yet, and that's cool. That'll be fun. I've said on a few places so far in the last... I saw it on Friday night. And I've said over the course of, we're recording this on Sunday, so over the course of late Friday and all day Saturday, I've said on a few places what I felt about it, but I've also made it no secret, as I ever do, right? I always say, with something like this, do not expect objectivity from me. Now, I'm gonna try to look at it from two different vantage points. There's the one vantage point, which is I want to look at it objectively and be as honest about it as I can, and I do want to do that. But on the other hand, bear in mind, not only is this a Marvel movie, not only is this an Avengers-related, you know, Marvel movie, which basically every Marvel movie is as of Infinity War, but this is a cosmic Marvel movie, and it's starring arguably one or both of my second and third favorite characters in all of comics. So I have very specific feelings about it that are emotional and that go back to when I was, you know, 8 years old or something. Now, before we get into it, let's say up front, we're going to do a little spoiler-free segment for those who just want to kind of get the gist, and then we'll sound the alarm, and we're going to dig deep, deep, deep into this movie. So just for a couple of minutes here, for those that have not seen it yet but want to, let's kind of give, what do you want to give, like a rating? We've never really set an official rating system on our shows, so... What kind of rating do you want to do? Out of 10? Out of 4? Out of 5 star? What do you think?
Well, the first thing I saw from you on Facebook after you saw it was out of 10. So
yes.
Just to keep consistent with what your feelings were.
Okay.
Cause your post that I saw said, before the mid-credit sequence, you would give this a 9 out of 10.
Yes.
And after the mid-credit sequence, it's a 10 out of 10.
Yes. Yes.
So I feel, I think it was probably a 7 or 8 out of 10.
Okay.
Until I saw that in that mid-credit sequence, and then, you know, like you, I would give it another point more than that,
just for that,
which seems wild because that was only like a 90-second scene. And we'll talk about it when we get into the spoiler segment, but you know, I and for me to say it's a 7 or 8 out of 10, I don't think is saying that we're looking at this wildly differently.
Right.
I think the reason that you feel it's a 9 out of 10 is, you know, like you said, your emotional attachment to the character since you were a kid reading comic books in the 70s.
Yes.
And, you know, I feel that way at times too, when I see some of these movies, and I'm not as attached to Captain Marvel or Carol Danvers as a character as you are. And I think that's where we have a point or two variance in our rating of the movie. You know, like when I see a Spider-Man movie or I see one of the Captain America movies, like that's where my connection to it comes.
Right.
And so I always rank those a little bit higher just because I've been reading those characters and loving those characters as long as you have, with Iron Man and Captain Marvel. So, I don't slight you for thinking it's a 9 out of 10, and you're not far off, you know, because it is a very good movie. Where I think it's interesting now, and I don't know that we've ever talked about this when we talk about the MCU here recently, is it is kind of at a point. I mean, we're 10 plus years into this where people that go to a Marvel movie really have seen all of the other ones, because in fact, I was just telling my wife before I came in to record, like literally every weekend on one of the cable networks, you will find 2 or 3 of the Marvel movies.
Yeah.
You know, and like today, as a matter of fact, FX is running, Captain America, First Avenger, Winter Soldier, then they're doing Thor, then they're showing Iron Man 3, and they're wrapping up tonight with Guardians of the Galaxy. So they've got like a full smorgasbord of Marvel movies on tap for the day. And it's easy for people to go back and watch all of the older ones and get caught up, even if they weren't on board 10 years ago when this thing started. So it's interesting because I don't know that they're writing or producing these movies for a completely uneducated audience anymore.
Yeah.
Which makes it a little bit more fun for them because they can do deeper dives into a character like Captain Marvel and not have to do as much heavy lifting, you know, much like they did with Black Panther. You know, it's easy for them to do these standalone movies now with these newer characters because we're much more accepting of the concepts.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Well, there's several things, obviously, I want to get into detail-wise, but do we have anything else that we want to say to the non-spoiler crowd before we tell them go to the theater and what are you waiting for crying out loud?
You know, one of the things that you mentioned earlier, because you said it seemed like we've been waiting for this movie for a while, and, you know, I had to remind myself, it's one of those kind of, like, surreptitious things that happens where this movie was supposed to come out a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And didn't, because Marvel worked out the deal with Sony to use Spider-Man. So Captain Marvel was slotted originally, if you remember, in the slot that Spider-Man Homecoming took, which would have been before Infinity War. Mm-hmm. It would have been right after Civil War. Is that right, when Homecoming came out?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, because they introduced Spider-Man in Civil War, and then they did Homecoming right after.
Yeah.
So, you know, story-wise, I think it's interesting because that Captain Marvel's playing a huge role in what's to come, especially with Endgame. And we'll get into that when we get into spoiler territory. But I wonder what it would have been had they released it a couple of years ago. Would we have gotten the exact same story that we got now?
Right.
I guess is what I wonder sometimes. You know, much like with Ant-Man, you know, because they drug Ant-Man out forever. And then, then right when they started to get serious about doing an Ant-Man movie, they realized they could use him in Civil War and do some other things with him and really integrated that character more with the other characters of the MCU than I think they planned originally. So it's always fun to me to think about what might have been and where the story could have taken us if they had done it as they originally planned. But I think where we're at now, this is the perfect place for them to introduce Carol and introduce Captain Marvel and the Kree and the Skrull and everything we get in this movie. It sets the stage really well for what's coming in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And yeah, I agree. It would have been a different movie. I mean, you know, they were originally going to use Captain Marvel in Infinity War. And I think they rightly decided they had enough characters already, you know, and she didn't really have enough to offer, to just throw her in the mix with 8 million other characters that we already knew when we wouldn't have known her. You know, it would have been like Spider-Man in Civil War, but everybody knew Spider-Man. Nobody really knew Captain Marvel. And I think that just teasing her with a little pager ended up working out better because it led great, you know, it was a great lead in into this movie and then back into the Avengers again. So I think they made the right choice, even though, you know, more Captain Marvel would have been fine with me. I think that strategically and story wise, it made more sense not to just throw her into the blender with all those other characters and have her be lost in her first appearance. Right. You know, her first appearance now is big.
And actually, the first, now that I think about it, I had completely forgotten until you jogged my memory. The first time we were supposed to see Captain Marvel was at the end of Age of Ultron. Yeah. Like they had planned on the end scene there where Black Widow and Cap go walking in to see the new team of Avengers. Like she was supposed to be one of the new Avengers.
Hmm.
You know, they do the shot of War Machine and Falcon Scarlet Witch, and you were supposed to see Captain Marvel there, and they decided not to do it at the last minute, I think, to kind of hold off Captain Marvel a little bit more. But yeah, you're right. I mean, this is the perfect way for them to bring her into the MCU.
Had they even cast Brie Larson at that point?
No. I don't think they cast Brie Larson until they got serious about
the
rescheduling and putting Captain Marvel in this spot.
Right.
Like, I don't even think they had Brie Larson cast when it was originally in that Spider-Man Homecoming slot.
All right. Well, we've waited long enough. Let's get into the nitty gritty. If you haven't seen the movie yet, you can hang around and listen, but we're going to spoil everything for you. So go watch the movie and come back. Pause the show right here and come back. By the way, if you're listening to this show through the White Rock Entertainment podcast feed and it rolls off your feed or whatever before you come back, be aware that I also post these as a permanent player. I don't think I've advertised this before, but just so people know, I always post Avengers Assemble podcast episodes of the White Rocket from the White Rocket feed as permanent players for each episode on the AvengersAssemble.net website. So I'm trying to get that website. Jim, that website, I created that website in 1995, and
I know you did.
It's old, and I brushed the I brushed the cobwebs off and dusted off every now and then, and try to keep it updated. And it's got a lot of good stuff now. It's lost a lot of the old stuff, but I got a lot of audio players on there with all the various episodes and stuff.
So you created the Avengers Assemble website the same year that Captain Marvel takes place.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that. That's right. That's right. Yeah, 1995. And so, wow, it's 24 years old as of September. But it's, yeah, it's got players for all the episodes. So you can go there and listen to any of our episodes without having to go hunting back through the podcast feed. All right, well, here we go. Let's get into the movie itself. Now, there's several specific things I want to talk about, and I'm sure you got several things you want to talk about too, but where should we, but I feel like we should begin more generally with the actual movie, the plot.
Well,
what did you think?
Yeah, well, and before we get into that, I have to say, since we're in spoiler territory now, I can talk to somebody about this. Marvel Studios, I don't know about you, but just the opening Marvel Studios at the beginning of it, I was not prepared to almost cry before the movie started.
I know.
But the fact that the Marvel Studios logo, you know, with their theme and everything coming up, the fact that they used all of Stan Lee's cameos in the logo build was amazing to me, and that we got the thank you, Stan card at the beginning of it, and I just thought, oh man, they're gonna make me cry before this movie even starts. So and I actually came home and told my wife that. I said, yeah, I got a little misty-eyed right at the beginning there.
My wife, her attitude toward all of this stuff sort of vacillates between putting up with and contempt, and so even she got kind of emotional about that. She was like, oh, that's, you know, so sweet and everything. So, and I don't want to be the guy that has anything negative to say about that. I just, and it's been a long time, but I just wish they could do something for Jack. I feel like right. Stan gets all the attention. And again, bless his heart, he just passed away. I don't want to be disrespectful. Not at all. I adore Stan, and I totally respect everything he did. I'm just saying there was another guy, you know, and he gets nothing. So it just always disappoints me there.
And I would like to hope, you know, depending on what happens in the future, now that they have the Fantastic Four back in the fold.
Yeah.
You know, if they do some FF stuff, or they do Silver Surfer and, you know, some of the hardcore Jack Kirby parts of the MCU, I think we might see some of that. At least I would hope so.
I hope so.
You know, considering the fact that they are taking the time to thank some creators that have worked on these characters over the years. You know, like I was really happy. I don't know if you noticed in the closing credits that, you know, they gave a shout out to Kelly Sue DeConnick for her contribution to Carol and Captain Marvel and the more recent characterization of her. So I thought that was kind of cool. excuse me. So yeah, I was almost crying before the movie started. One of the things that I really liked about this movie was the mystery of it for a good chunk of the first half.
Yeah.
We didn't jump into, hey, here's Carol Danvers, here she is on Earth. You know, they didn't do the typical setup of the lead character and what her backstory is. There was a lot of questions that I had going through it. And I think that that was good because for the first, I don't know what, third half of the movie, like you're led to believe that she is a Kree.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been a Kree her whole life. And she's just having these visions of other lives and things that happen. And you don't really know why she's having these visions. And I really liked that because I felt like it added something beyond the stereotypical hero origin story. There was a little bit of a mystery to it that needed to be solved. And I liked that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought the opening and I thought it opened really in a kick butt kind of way with the Star Force, whatever. I mean, I know that they kind of, they sort of do a heel turn toward the end of the movie in the final act. Even though they're really just doing their job, you know, that's what they are. They're a military force. But I really enjoyed them when they were still who we were rooting for. You know, like they're a special ops team, and you know, I love the little special ops teams. And yep. I like them at the beginning where you get to see them do their different roles, and you have the sniper and the, you know, and which is odd that Dr. Minerva was a sniper. But anyway, and by the way, that was one, you know, thing I had to wrestle with this movie is that they really, it's like they had a bucket full of the actual characters from the comics, and they had a bucket full of ideas of how all this stuff would work in the MCU. And they really just kind of poured both buckets in the blender. And what came out did not offend me or insult me or disappoint me too much because it worked. You know, it's like what when John Ringer and I were reviewing the Lord of the Rings movies, one of the things we kept talking about, if I recall correctly, was it's not insulting to Tolkien fans if it works. You know what I mean? You can can change things if it makes it stronger for this movie, for this particular medium. They didn't go back and burn everybody's comics. You know, they didn't go back and liquid paper over panels in your comic book. So it's still there. They just, for this new medium, changed things around a little bit to work better in this environment. And I kept having to tell myself that because I kept thinking, oh, no. And like, okay, it works. It works. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, okay, it works. So, and you know, there's a big one we'll talk about in a few minutes, but
right.
Well, that one I really wrestled with.
Yeah. And I understand what you're saying because it's kind of the same thing that I run into in theater a lot when people are doing an adaptation of Shakespeare. Because, you know, nowadays you can't do a 5-hour version of Hamlet that people are going to sit through. And so, you know, I always tell directors when they're trying to figure out how to stage Shakespeare that as long as you stay committed to the core story, anything that you get rid of or anything you change up will work. And, you know, the audience is going to buy it because you're not changing the fundamental parts of the story that they're coming for. And I think that's what they did brilliantly with the Lord of the Rings movies in paring those down. And like you said, I mean, they're doing it in the MCU because there are times where I feel like they have an idea of a character they want to use in a movie. And there's no real character in the Marvel Comics universe that fits that trope or that stereotype character. And so, but we need a name for this person. So we want it to have some connection. So we're just going to pull a name out of a hat.
Exactly.
You know, and I feel like that's what they did with some of the Kree. It's like, okay, we have all these Kree characters from the comics. As long as we use their names, it'll be okay. Because these are really cool characters on the screen. And we're not really trying to tell the comic stories anyway. So, you know, as long as we get close to the character, we're fine.
Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly. And the only time it's disappointing, I think, the only time is if you, the viewer, were really kind of had your heart set on seeing the character whose name they use that way in their original form. So in other words, if there's like somewhere in the world, there might be three big Dr. Minerva fans. I doubt it, but maybe there are, right? Maybe there's three. They're really disappointed now because their super villain, you know, evil character is now just like a soldier. And that's,
well, and what's the biggest example of that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe? With the Mandarin.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so many people were looking forward to Ben Kingsley playing the Mandarin.
So many people, including one right here. But I'm trying not to go.
And we didn't get that. Now, you know, they tried to save face with that Marvel short that they did on one of the DVDs where they tried to set up that the Ten Rings is real and that, you know, there is a Mandarin out there someplace that is, you know, the villainous Mandarin we all know and love from the comics, but we still haven't seen him on screen yet.
And we never will, and they've let that go. And I knew as soon as they, when that video came out, like for 2 minutes, I'm like, oh, they're setting up a, and then I was like, no, they're not. This is just a bone they're throwing to people like me, and they're never going to mention the character again. And I was right. So, but
the other thing, and this kind of will dovetail back to Captain Marvel and some of your feelings on it, because the other thing that I have to remind myself about with all of these movies is that they don't have the luxury of telling these stories over a 50-year period.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of the stuff that we love about the Marvel Comics universe has been built on, you know, the stories that Jack and Stan told in the 60s and Steve Ditko told and, you know, John Romita told. And then when you get into the 70s and you have guys like Roy Thomas and Jim Shooter and, you know, all that next generation of creative talent come in, they were building on the stuff that the original Marvel creators did. And so we have this rich tapestry of character and story that's been told pretty much during our lifetime. And the Marvel movies don't have that luxury. Like, they're trying to tell the same kinds of stories in a more condensed version.
Mm-hmm. And some things have to go, and some things have to be really simplified down. And I get that. And it's really kind of a lottery. You're just like, oh, I really like this character. Man, I hope they make it. And I've been particularly disappointed that two of my favorite characters, I mean, you know, out of four of my absolute favorite characters, we've gotten two of them better than I could have ever hoped, and two of them pretty much gotten thrown under the bus to a certain degree. So we got Iron Man, and he just dominates the whole MCU, and that's a 15 out of 10 for me. There's no conceivable way Iron Man could have worked out better for me when he came into the MCU. You know what I mean? There's just no way.
Yeah.
That's a grand slam home run times 10. Okay. For Ms. Marvel, Captain Marvel, that's great, too. Again, she got her own movie. She's going to be big in the next Avengers movie. I couldn't ask for anything more than that. Now, on a sliding scale, with Iron Man at the top and then Captain Marvel, as we keep sliding down, then we get to probably Warlock, okay, because he hasn't shown up yet and he's missed out on his big story. But he has been established in his original form, and we could see him conceivably later. So he's kind of just a question. And then of the four at the bottom, and this is not in a hugely bad way, I'm still wrestling with it, is Mar-Vell. Because that door is now closed, and you got what you got, and either you like it, or you accept it, or you hate it. And we'll talk about that. We'll get there. So, but I agree. I think that, yeah, they have just a certain number of movies and a certain number of hours to get everything in. And honestly, we'd be crazy to complain. You know, I mean, you can't have everything. You want everything, but not everybody can have everything in a finite period of movies. You know, you just can't. So let's talk about the Skrulls, all right? And then we can talk about Mar-Vell, and we can talk about things we didn't like in the movie. But I want to talk about the Skrulls, because this is the big pointy-eared alien in the room that we kind of need to get around. So I will first I'm going to posit to you two scenarios, and you tell me what you think about how it could have gone and how it did. All right, the two scenarios. One scenario is that the Skrulls are the way we see them in the comics. They're duplicitous. They're I wouldn't say evil, but they're conniving. They're sneaky. They're ambitious. They want to, you know, they're just like the Kree in a different way. I was having to explain to my family after the movie that, no, the Skrulls aren't like happy, sweet people. They're just as bad as the Kree, just in a different way. Neither side is really good, you know. So on the one hand, we get the Skrulls in this movie the way they were in the comics, okay? That leads to certain unavoidable consequences, which I'm prepared to go into. On the other hand, you have the Skrulls being what they were in the movie, which is a put-upon, downtrodden refugee people who just want to breathe the clear air of freedom. So what did you think about how they played out in the movies, and which of those scenarios do you now would have preferred?
Well, it's weird because I was, as an audience goer, I was pleasantly surprised with what they did with the Skrulls in this movie, mm-hmm. because I thought they could have been the stereotypical mm-hmm. shape-shifting villains who, you know, just use their shape-shifting abilities to create this sense of distrust amongst all of the heroes and, you know, not really knowing who is who, and just adding to the mystery and the espionage of it all, which is how they've been used in the comics more recently. And I liked that they kind of did the 180 in this and didn't treat them like that. And I think part of it is because of Ben Mendelsohn's performance as Talos, because I really thought he brought something to the character mm-hmm. that it's weird to say humanize an alien race, but you know, he did make them relatable. And the fact that he was doing all of this to save his family and, you know, all of that, and it really made it a more personal stakes sort of thing versus we're just fighting this war amongst two intergalactic races. You know, it almost struck me, and I think you'll appreciate this analogy, it almost struck me the way that Straczynski used the Narn in Babylon 5.
Yeah, that's good. Where I hadn't thought of that.
In the first season, you know, they're presented as the bad guys.
Oh, yeah.
And you go into it thinking, well, these guys are the worst. You know, they're our version of the Romulans or the Klingons in Babylon 5.
Right.
And, you know, they're the race that we're going to be fighting against. And the more you learn about them, the more you realize, no, wait a minute. The Centauri enslaved them, and the Centauri did all this bad stuff to the Narn. So the Narn were basically just fighting back and trying to reclaim what was theirs and won the war. And it was really the Centauri who were the bad guys in that conflict. And I think that's what I got out of what they were doing with the Kree and the Skrull in this. It was basically changing our perceptions of who the righteous side was in this conflict. And, you know, I kind of think, because the one thing we kept hearing over and over again in the promotion for this movie was that the Kree-Skrull War was going to come to Earth. And, you know, that this was going to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really get the sense that we got a full-scale Kree-Skrull War on the big screen yet. And I wonder if they're saving that for a sequel to show Captain Marvel ending the war and getting more into the conflict between the Kree and the Skrull a little bit.
Well, it doesn't seem like the Skrull are up for a war at this point. The Skrulls they're like, they've already lost the war, it seems like, and they're just trying to get out of Dodge. That was what was interesting to me, was that, you know, she's, when she goes off, apparently for like 20 years or whatever, when she goes off to end the Kree-Skrull War, it's not a matter of ending the war so much as it is knocking down the winners, it seems like.
Well, and because the one thing I had to keep reminding myself was that this was a period movie set in the 90s. And so, you know, I was trying to extrapolate where they go from the end of Captain Marvel with her basically telling Ronan the Accuser that she's coming for the Kree and she's going to end the war one way or the other, and where we see the Kree in Guardians of the Galaxy. Because it seems like everything in Guardians of the Galaxy, when we see them, it's all, you know, sunshine and rainbows, except for Ronan.
Mm.
And he seems to be like a guy that hasn't let go of the fact that they lost, or that the war was ended in a way he didn't want it to end. And so, you know, it's, I think there's more story left to be told here, but it's was such an interesting way for them to present the Kree-Skrull conflict, because I wasn't expecting it.
Well, a couple of things that occur to me about it. One is I like the twist of it, because it worked in how they portrayed Carol, right? At the beginning of the movie, you assume she's good. You assume Starforce is good. You like Jude Law, you know, and they all seem like buddies and everything. They're like Marines going off on a you know, like a SEAL team or something. So you figure they're the good guys. And so that means anybody fighting her and her team are bad. So then later on, when you realize that she's with bad-ish people, that makes her opponent seem better, because if they were fighting the bad guys and she was inadvertently with the bad guys, then they must not be as bad, you know, somehow. So that was kind of cool, because like you said, it was part of that mystery that we had going through the whole movie is, you know, not just who is she, but what's going on with her involvement with the Kree? What's going on with Jude Law's character, and who is he? What's going on with the Supreme? There was just a lot of interesting, you know, and what's going on with the Skrull? So, and they took advantage of the fact that, again, like you said, the shape-shifting aliens are always bad. There's, you know, I guess other than the Odo on Deep Space Nine, there's rarely occasion where a shape-shifting alien is a good guy. And so, you just naturally assume, oh, they're on Earth and they're pretending to be humans. They must be up to no good, right? They've got to be up to no good. But that brings me to the second thing that I thought was interesting, which is one of the benefits of the Skrulls being benign and friendly and not evil is there's two benefits. One, it means that they've gone off and left the Earth, presumably, so they're not on Earth taking over our government and all that, which is fine because that's a done-to-death story. And number two, we've already kind of seen that exact story anyway with Hydra. They weren't aliens, right, but they were doing the same thing. So do we really need another, you know, and we're not, but did we really need another storyline where, you know, Earth leaders are being taken over by an evil outside conspiracy, whether they're alien or human? We had that with Hydra. You know, I mean, you could go back and redo Winter Soldier and have Robert Redford be a Skrull instead of Hydra, and it'd be the same thing, basically. So I don't think that you just find out that the Skrulls worked with Hitler, basically, you know, and with Arnim Zola. So I'm glad the Skrulls are something else besides a more exotic version of Hydra.
No, I think you're right, and I hadn't thought about that before, because I think a lot of us assumed, since they were introducing the Skrulls, that somewhere down the line we were going to get Secret Invasion.
Right.
And I agree with you, because now that I think about it, I think you're right. A Secret Invasion story, other than adding the element of we don't know which heroes are really heroes, mm-hmm, and which ones are Skrulls, it's not adding anything new that we didn't see in Winter Soldier.
Yeah. It really isn't.
And if you need an excuse to pit heroes against heroes in a fight scene, there are better story opportunities, yes, than using Secret Invasion.
Yes, and Secret Invasion, for all that it's kind of a neat thing in Marvel history, in some ways, it's such a Brian Bendis thing. It's such a Damon Lindelof thing where you say, I've got this idea. It's totally out of character for every character involved, but it's so neat of an idea that I'm going to twist the characters to fit into my idea. That is not how you write. That's not how you construct a good story. Who liked the stuff like Secret Invasion? Not people that had been reading those characters for 30 years and knew those characters. The people that liked it was younger readers that thought it was a neat story, or I guess older readers that just liked the idea. But even I think older readers like me, reading stories like that, were like, that's really not in how they would act. You know, Civil War in the comics was the same way, which is why we talked about how the Civil War movie was so much better than how it was executed in the comics. Again, it's one of these ideas. I just am totally dead set against stories, big stories, where the plot device drives it rather than the characters, because the characters always end up getting subverted to the needs of the plot device, and I hate that. right? It's about treating characters honestly and having them behave honestly and react realistically. And when characters are out of character for the sake of a plot device, to me, it just absolutely ruins the story to me. So,
well, and you're right on point with Civil War being the best example of that, because in the comics, I always felt like that storyline was purely story driven. And, you know, like you said, they just pushed the characters that were round pegs into square holes, yeah, just to make it work, versus the movie version of that same storyline where it was character driven. Mm-hmm. Like everything that happens in the Civil War movie happens because of character, not because it's just a plot contrivance.
Exactly. Exactly. And honestly, I don't need a movie now coming out in like 2021 or something that tells me that the Falcon in Civil War was a Skrull or something. I just don't need that. Honestly, right, right. I have no interest in that.
And again, you know, this kind of goes back to something that we've talked about in previous shows about other things, like with Star Trek, the reboot of Star Trek with J.J. Abrams was consistently trying to do things with those characters that were not earned within that timeline.
Absolutely right.
And you know, the reason Wrath of Khan works is because it was an earned moment because of the years of history that we had with those characters and those actors. In the Marvel Cinematic Universe, I don't know that Secret Invasion works as well because some of those moments have not been earned over decades worth of storytelling.
Right. Now that's it. That's it. So, the other big thing, I mean, there's several things to talk about in this movie. And by the way, here's a little thing, but it's just something that made me so happy. I have waited so long to see a superhero with cosmic powers actually use them on the movie screen. And yes, there have been a few instances here and there where we kind of got a little bit of that in one way or another. I mean, you know, we get Iron Man with his repulsor blast, but that's just a technological thing. This, having her flying around and zapping people, is what I have waited for in a superhero movie my whole life, because that's my favorite type of powers in comics, is the ones that fly. It's one of the many reasons I love Marvel and Ms. Marvel, as they were when I was reading them back in the day, is because they could fly around and zap people. I love that. And so we've had acrobats and archers, we've had brawlers, we've had armor, Thor to a certain degree, but he just hits you with his hammer or strikes you with lightning. That's a little more mundane. But we haven't really had a cosmic powered blaster before, and we've got one now, and I'm so happy. Did that do anything for you?
Well, I mean, the one thing that it did was it, you know, like you said, we're going now to a whole other power level,
yeah,
with some of these characters. So, you know, you can look on the horizon and see, especially when you hear them throwing things like Eternals around as a potential movie down the road. You know, we're going to keep getting bigger and better and more powerful things down the road. And so you do kind of need to set up a Captain Marvel now, so that there's a balance there. You know, if we're going to have these cosmic villains coming into play, then you have to have somebody that can at least stand toe to toe with them and fight them on their level. You know, like you said, I mean, we kind of have that with Thor, in a way, but it's also the reason why Thor has to disappear for huge chunks of the Avengers movies,
yeah,
because there needs to be moments where he's not around to save the day so that you have a little bit of a threat and some back and forth with the villains and the heroes, and then Thor can swoop in. And so I do kind of wonder how they're going to fit Captain Marvel into Endgame because of that, and how much we're actually going to see of her, because it does seem like she outpowers everybody on the Avengers combined.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be, there's always the contrivance of whoever, you know, in a fight, the winner is whoever the writer wants to fight, to win. But, you know, because Cap's got all of his abilities and his shield, so he could stand up to her. Iron Man, it would be rough. Movie Iron Man is not as magically powerful as comics Iron Man could be, so, but it would be rough. She could just keep knocking Hulk back, and he could never actually get to her. Thor and Captain Marvel would be a very interesting fight, because she'd blast away at him, and he'd throw his hammer, and it'd be tough to see. I don't know. That would be a fun fight. But anyway, I'm just happy to have that. Now, the other thing about it that I wanted to mention is the whole idea of Mar-Vell. So let's establish first how in the comics, right? In the comics, the way that, for those that don't know, here's how the story, and I've had a lot of friends on Twitter that have been asking me stuff like, well, is this like it is in the comics? What's this like? You know, I've been trying to explain to people for the last 3 days, you know, no, it's like this in the comics. So let me quickly run through it. So in the comics, Mar-Vell was basically, you know, to a certain degree, a member of Star Force to a certain degree. He ends up on Earth and decides that the Kree are being mean and he's going to protect Earth instead of attacking it with the Kree. So he changes sides, and then later he gains greater powers, though he gets it from Eon, I believe, a big kind of like the Kurt Russell character in Guardians of the Galaxy 2, a character like that, a big planet type character, gives him these powers and makes him protector of the universe. He protects Earth. And when he's fighting the Kree, there's an explosion of a machine, similar to the movie, and his DNA gets transferred to a certain degree into Carol, and she gains powers similar to his. And she becomes Ms. Marvel. And then, you know, years later, he dies of cancer, which is a whole other thing. There's a graphic novel that explains it. So he's dead. She's still Ms. Marvel for a while. She changes names a bunch of times and ends up in the last 10 years or so finally taking on the name of Captain Marvel after, by the way, the Captain Marvel that was the first female Captain Marvel after Mar-Vell but before Carol was the little girl in this movie, which I thought was really neat.
Right.
So we'll get to that. So anyway, so she finally becomes Captain Marvel. They just in the movie compressed all of that down from like 50 years into, because Captain Marvel debuted in 67 and Carol first appeared in 68. So it's been 51, 52 years. They compressed all that down into just basically a segment of a 2-hour movie. So now
and I don't necessarily know that they did a good enough job in the movie of really kind of spelling out Mar-Vell as a character and what the character had been doing up to the point that we see her in the movie. Because am I right in assuming that basically they use that the backstory from the comics of Mar-Vell realizing that they're fighting on the wrong side of things and trying to help the Skrulls by coming up with the movie's MacGuffin?
Yeah. Yeah. And they just drop little hints here and there.
And basically, Mar-Vell came to Earth to do their experiments and invent this. I mean, they talk about that they were working on a light speed drive, but what they really needed was the power source for the light speed drive.
Yeah. Which was the space gem, the cosmic cube, the tesseract.
And we need to get that. It's the Tesseract, which, correct me if I'm wrong here, because this was the one complaint I had in the entire movie, because I'm a stickler for making sure that we follow continuity that's been established.
Mm-hmm.
So in Captain America, the Tesseract... In the first Avenger, I want to follow the timeline of the Tesseract.
Good luck. So, it's the one that's been around the block the most times, and it's very confusing. So let's try it.
Right. But I want to see if I'm remembering things correctly. So in the first Avenger, we see the Red Skull at the beginning of the movie go to the church in Norway and pull the wall apart because he's looking for the Tesseract, and he finds it there. And the Tesseract is used as the MacGuffin for First Avenger. He's using it. Him and Arnim Zola are experimenting with it. They're using it to power all of these crazy Nazi weapons. And at the end of the movie, it goes into the ocean when Cap crashes the plane.
Okay.
Correct?
I think it's been a while.
In that movie.
It's been a while since I've watched that one, but I think that all rings true. Okay.
And then when they do the flash forward and he wakes up in the hospital and escapes and ends up, you know, being confronted by Nick Fury in Times Square, you realize he's in the present. Then we go to Avengers, the first Avengers movie, which establishes that Howard Stark found the Tesseract.
Yeah.
And that they've been experimenting with it since Howard Stark found it in the ocean while he was looking for Cap. And that's where they had it in Project Pegasus in the Avengers movie.
Yes. That's right.
Now, that was post 1995. So are we to assume that Marvel's been experimenting on it or working with Project Pegasus this whole time?
Yeah.
Using the Tesseract?
Yes.
Okay. I thought I may have missed something, and I wanted to make sure I was clear about it, because I was like, wait a minute, how did Marvel get the Tesseract?
Yeah, so Stark had it, S.H.I.E.L.D. had it, Nick Fury had it, Project Pegasus was being built in 95. Remember, that was the facility we were in, and they were building it then, and Marvel had been around helping them as a Air Force person or whatever, Dr. Lawson, working on it. And so where did it end up after that? Because I'm trying to think, when does it come back into play? The next thing I remember is Thanos crushing the cube and getting it out.
Well,
but
I'm assuming that Nick Fury took it after the final closing credits sequence of Captain Marvel when it was deposited on his desk.
On his desk, yep.
That he took it back to Project Pegasus.
Right.
At least that's my assumption. And that's been sitting there being investigated by all of the various S.H.I.E.L.D. scientists until we see it again in the first Avengers movie.
And where does it go after the first Avengers movie? Don't the Asgardians take it or something? Or am I thinking about a different one?
No, you're right. They because Thor takes it.
He puts it in like a box or something, right? And
And they use the power of the Tesseract to get back to Asgard.
And it goes back to Asgard, and we assume then that the Asgardians put it in that church? No, this is later. I'm sorry.
They
have it.
Yeah.
So when they have it, how does it end up with Thanos?
I think he gets it at the beginning of Infinity War.
Yeah. From Loki? Yeah, because Loki had it hidden or something.
Loki had it.
Yeah.
So funny. I just wanted, there was a chunk of time in the middle there where I was like, okay, where did Marvel get it? And all of that. So do you find it weird when you're talking to people about this movie and you're referencing Marvel as a character and having to say she?
Yes. Well, that's where I'm heading with all this, is what they did with Marvel, right? Because Marvel, Captain Marvel, I have to admit here that I've always been annoyed every single time in my life that I've had to say Captain Marvel, right? Just to make it clear, every single time I've ever had to do that, I always am a little annoyed that I can't just say Captain Marvel, because that's who he was to me growing up reading those comics, the great Jim Starlin issues, the great Bill Mantlow and Pat Broderick issues, or was it Doug Moench? I get them confused. They're both great. Anyway, yeah, up until Starling killed him off. And so, yeah, that character is very, very important to me. We're talking about the red and blue with the blonde hair. And not not the female red and blue with the blonde hair, the male red and blue with the blonde hair. And so, yeah, basically they just did a gender swap. And, I mean, I'm sitting there when I figured out that Annette Bening is not only the Supreme Intelligence, because that's who Carol sees, and she's not only this professor that Carol knew in the Air Force, and she's also Captain Mar-Vell. I'm like, right. Wait a minute, what? And I'm thinking, you know, I think that's why that there's no doubt Marvel has been leading us to believe Jude Law was playing Mar-Vell. Because I think that they figured we would know Mar-Vell was going to be in the movie, and Jude Law is the actor that seems like he would most likely play that role. And I was very disappointed when I found out he was going to be Yon Rogg, who I knew was a villain. I mean, that was one thing I have to admit that disappointed me and was kind of a spoiler, was when they say that he's Yon Rogg, I immediately go, well, Yon Rogg is one of Mar-Vell's biggest enemies. So immediately, the whole is Jude Law's character good or bad? I immediately assumed he was bad, even though he was being nice to her and good through the first half of the movie, because the name he's carrying around is of a bad guy. You know, I mean, it's like if you made a new Superman movie and Superman's buddy is Lex Luthor, you're like, wait a minute, there's no way this is a good guy, you know?
Right, right.
So what did you think about Mar-Vell turning out to be Annette Bening and Captain Marvel always being a female, basically?
Well, yeah, I thought it was interesting because, like you said, I mean, it kind of surprises you a little bit because you're not expecting it. And I think they were smart, because I know Annette Bening in interviews for the last couple of weeks has hinted and dropped the news that she was playing the Supreme Intelligence. And I thought, okay, well, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, and it would be really cool if she's not really, like, that's not what the Supreme Intelligence looks like. It's just a projection or, you know, some sort of computer imagery, because you can't really see what the Supreme Intelligence looks like, you know. And I liked what they did with that.
Yes.
Everybody's vision of the Supreme Intelligence is different.
Yeah.
Depending on, you know, who the most important person to them is in their life or whatever. I kind of liked that. And it added to the mystery when you realize that Carol doesn't know who this person is that she's seeing when she talks to the Supreme Intelligence. Like, yeah, everybody else knows, hey, this is my dad, or this mm-hmm. is my best friend, or this is my teacher, you know, whoever. And she sees this image and doesn't know who that person is and really wants to solve that mystery. And, you know, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, that I really liked the mystery aspect of it. And once all the pieces started to come together, I thought, oh, well, this is kind of cool. I do like the idea that Annette Bening was Mar-Vell, and, you know, that Mar-Vell came to Earth and was working on, you know, all these different things and trying to stop the war. And that basically the concern that you and I both had, that we were going to get a Captain Marvel movie that didn't reference Mar-Vell at all.
Yes. Yes. That would have been so wrong.
Kind of went out the window as soon as they kind of put those pieces together. And I thought, okay, this is cool. I mean, it's not exactly the Mar-Vell from the comic, but it's enough of it to make the story work.
Yeah.
And I don't mind it.
I'm sitting there in the theater discovering all this, and I'm wrestling. I'm like, okay, I have in my mind a sense of who I want this character to be. And I'm like, am I okay with Annette Bening being this character, or do I feel betrayed? And I said to myself, I said to myself, it's being done in a respectful way. The only real difference is that she doesn't fly around and have powers herself, and that she's a different gender. That's it. And I said, if we're going to just skip right over to the Ms. Marvel story and skip the Captain Marvel story, this is the most respectful, best way I can imagine doing it. So I made the decision in the theater that I was okay with it and that it was cool. Now, bear in mind, this could easily have been the Mandarin again. And if they had gone that route, I would be beyond furious. Because with the Mandarin, it was a fake out for the sake of the story, and it insulted the character, and it belittled the character, and therefore the fans of that character, like me, who he was always the main villain of my favorite hero. You know, he was my Lex Luthor if you're a Superman fan. He was my Joker if you're a Batman fan. And that really upset me in terms of being a fan. But this was not that. Mar-Vell was not the Mandarin because of the way they did it. And so I'm okay with it. And I wish that Shane Black could take a page from the creators of this movie and go back and redo it. But I think it says a lot, too, that they were so upset about the reveal of the Funko Pop. I think they tried to cover it up, that they were trying to say, oh, no, this doesn't spoil anything, but it really did. Because I think that Marvel and the licensed people and the probably some bureaucrats in the middle, right, dropped the ball. They assumed that either Jon Rogg was a made-up name with no history, or that five people on Earth knew who Jon Rogg was from the comics. Well, maybe five people did, but I was one of them. And we were all going, Jon Rogg is a villain. Jon Rogg is a villain. So either this is a mistake if he's playing Mar-Vell, or you've just given away that Jude Law plays a villain in this movie. And so my biggest disappointment going into this movie was that I was 90% confident Jude Law was going to be a bad guy and going to do a heel turn somewhere in the movie. And I was looking for it. And I think I would have enjoyed the movie more if I'd thought Jude Law was a good guy from the beginning. There would have been more of a surprise, you know?
Well, I almost wonder if it wouldn't have been better to save his heel turn for another movie. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Like, you know, get through this movie. Yeah, I get it. You know, because they could have played out pretty much all of the same story beats.
Yeah.
And just not had him be as much of a bad guy.
Yeah, he could have just been a soldier, right? Trying to get and to some way he was. But don't you think he kind of crossed the line a little bit into outright villainy a couple of times? I mean, by the end, he was just antagonizing her because he was a jerk. There's a difference between being a jerk toward her, though, and being a villain. And I felt like he crossed that line, but I'm open to being told I'm wrong.
No, I think the parts of it where he crossed into the villainy territory versus just kind of being a jerk all have to do with the fact that you're dealing with non-combatants in a war scenario. Because you've got all of those Skrull families that were on the ship, and they were just flat out going to shoot him out in an airlock.
Okay, I'd forgotten about it. And as I said, when I've seen a movie once, I can't remember all the details. And yeah, okay, so that's exactly it. I knew that I felt like he was a villain, but I couldn't remember the specific things. You know, the things that stand out for me with him are the things where he's interacting with Carol. And in those cases, he was a huge jerk, but he was never like, I'm going to kill you, muhahaha. It's more like, you should obey me. You should do things my way, which is not quite the same.
And you kind of get that, especially at the end.
Yeah.
When, you know, they do have their face off and he's kind of like still trying to egg her on. You know, there was a part of me that was like, okay, he's clearly a bad guy, but there's a part of him that I wonder if he's just still not trying to be the trainer of her.
Yeah.
And push her to do more with her powers or be more in control. And when, you know, they have that face off and he kind of eggs her on and is like, okay, this is the moment I've been waiting for. Let's do this. you know, if you can beat me without your powers, then you'll prove that you've ascended. And, you know, the fact that she doesn't take the bait, I kind of liked, and was enjoyable to me that she just kind of photon blasted him. And
I loved it. Somebody called that her Indiana Jones moment with the sword fighter guy.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is.
And I agree. I was first surprised, but then I thought, yeah, I mean, he's like, at that point, he really, on the one hand, he's almost Jude Law does a great performance with it, right? He almost convinces you that she should do that. But in another way, it's like he's the villain in every like Western saying, I lost my gun, put your gun down and let's fist fight. And right. She's like, why should I put my gun down? You know, like the swashbuckling sword fighters, one guy drops his sword and he says, why don't you put your sword down and let's fight fist to fist? No, I've still got my sword. I'm going to beat you. I mean, why should she do that? So yeah, there was a split second where he almost fooled me. And then I'm like, oh, come on, just zap him. And she does, and that was awesome. And I was very pleased with that. What did you think about the idea, by the way, speaking of zapping him, that she is essentially a living Infinity Gem?
It's, you know, one of the first things I thought of when they did the reveal of how she got her powers was, is that how she's going to be able to stand toe-to-toe with Thanos? Because he has an infinity gauntlet that has infinity stones, and the gauntlet it looks like at the end of Infinity War that the snap damaged the infinity gauntlet. So I almost feel like Thanos is going to be working with, not as much power as he had. Versus somebody who, you know, is she the living embodiment of the Tesseract? I mean, how much of the Tesseract's power did she absorb?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so, I mean, that's something we don't know. And it's going to be kind of cool to see how they play that out.
Yeah, it is. Couple of other things. One, I feel like Marvel has learned that we really like having cute critters in these movies, whether it be Rocket and Groot or whatever. They figured out, throw in something cute and crittery and the kids will love it, we'll love it, you know, makes it more of a family film. And the cat really was fun. My favorite moment was when they took off in the proto Quinjet or whatever and Goose is stuck to the back wall. I about lost it. That was great. I expected the Flurkin stuff. That wasn't a surprise to me. Man, my family was surprised. and also it gave the opportunity for one of my favorite lines in the movie, which was for Fury to go, "Mother Flurkin."
Yeah, yeah.
That was awesome. So what do you think about Goose?
I liked what they did. I mean, they needed some lighter moments in the movie because, you know, without it, it is a pretty straightforward, more dramatic movie than we've normally gotten from Marvel. It's kind of, you know, I look at it now like they're really good at putting those moments into these movies to add some levity to what would normally not be a lighter situation. You know, it's one of the reasons why we get all the really fun Shuri moments in Black Panther.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, without him, it's basically just a pretty rote, dramatic superhero movie. And, you know, there aren't moments of levity without Shuri being in Black Panther. And I think you needed that with this, too. And, you know, who doesn't enjoy watching Samuel L. Jackson fawn over a cat?
Yeah. and what about his eye?
It added something to Nick Fury, too.
It did,
You know, it definitely seeing Nick Fury in a different light than we've seen him in all of these other movies where he's been a pretty dark character was fun.
I gotta be honest, if a cat scratched me in the face and caused me to lose my eye, I wouldn't have the cat around anymore.
Well, and I don't think you would either if it was a normal cat.
Well, but, it had the yeah, that's true.
It also, it had the Tesseract.
Yeah.
And And I knew as soon as the as soon as Goose swallowed the Tesseract, I knew what was coming at some point.
Yeah.
And then when they showed, you know, in the final post-credits scene, when Goose jumps up on Nick Fury's desk, I was like, oh, here we go. That's yep. It's going to be the Tesseract hairball. I know it's coming.
Yep, yep. We got to talk about that. Well, there's two things left on my agenda. And there's a million things we could talk about with this movie, but we don't want to be here all day. But there's two more things I want to talk about. One is that mid-credit scene that we both loved, right? That's the impression I got from what you were saying. It's that I wasn't expecting the Avengers.
Can we save that for just a minute, though?
Yeah.
Because what was the other thing on your list that you want to cover? Is that something we need to talk about after the post-credit sequence?
No. The other thing that I had on my list is its connections, how many connections this movie had to the earliest MCU movies, that it sets up so many things that surprised me. We've touched on that a little bit, but we haven't like directly talked about how, you know, this just leads into so many other things. I was just shocked at like, well, this does this, it does this, it does this. So,
One of the things that I wanted to touch on before we do the credit sequence is, the early looks that we've gotten from this movie at S.H.I.E.L.D. and it left me with more questions than it gave me answers to. But I did like the fact that this was basically like Phil Coulson's rookie adventure as an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., which was kind of fun. I thought they give Coulson, you know, enough to do without kind of hitting us over the head with it. And, you know, like I said, it was cool seeing Nick Fury at the dawn of him realizing just how big the universe is and starting to put the pieces in place for S.H.I.E.L.D. to be able to react to it. And, you know, in fact, I didn't see this coming, but I love the fact that he changed the name to the Avengers Initiative based on Carol's call sign.
Yeah,
as a pilot, I thought that was cool, and it was a cool way to connect Captain Marvel to the beginning of the Avengers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did not see that coming at all. I thought that was pretty cool. But again, it's just one more connection. Like I'm saying, it's because.
The one thing that has always bothered me about the movie version, the MCU version of the Avengers, is that they really don't have a reason to be called the Avengers.
No.
In the comic,
it's even worse.
There's a reason.
No, there's a reason, which is Jan says, hey, what about the Avengers? That sounds good. Oh, my God.
Right. But it's like, you know, when we get, you know, which is still, out of all the post-credit scenes that they've done in the MCU, that first one in Iron Man with Nick Fury in Tony's house saying, I'm here to talk about the Avengers Initiative, is still one of the most mind-blowing things I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, yeah.
But there was never a reason. Like, throughout all of these movies, it still bugs me that I'm like, why are they called the Avengers? Like, shouldn't they theoretically be the Defenders or the Guardians? Or, like, isn't there a name? Like, what are we avenging? And the fact that they brought it full circle and that that's why they're the Avengers, I loved it because it instantly solved a problem that I've had since the very beginning.
Yep. That's cool.
And speaking of the Avengers, since you wanted to talk about the mid-credits sequence, you know, you said in your Facebook post that I saw that it was a 9 out of 10 before you saw the mid-credits sequence, and then you saw that, and it made it a 10 out of 10. Like,
yes.
And I agree with you. Like, that was the one thing that I wanted to talk to somebody about as soon as I was done seeing it was how awesome that scene was.
Yes. I just wasn't expecting to see the Avengers in this movie. I guess in hindsight it made sense, but it was that this movie was set in 1995 and that was, you know, part of it. And then number two, we'd gotten so involved in the story of this specific movie that I guess I just didn't think about them showing present day. And so right. when we see Cap, I was like, oh, holy crap, it's Cap. And then it's Natasha. And on and on, you know, and then Rhodey, right? And then and that was cool enough, just seeing them and seeing the pager. So that tied back into the end of Infinity War, and I was excited then. I was like, okay, that's cool. We got the Avengers, we got the pager, you know, and then the Hulk, right? Banner, right? All four of them are there. And then
they knew that Fury was gone.
Yeah,
and they didn't know what the pager was for. They just, because there's dialogue where they're talking about they hooked it up to another power source to keep it going.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't know where the signal's going or who it's going to, but they felt it was important because Fury felt it was important that that's the last thing he did.
Yeah. And then.
And they make such a big deal in the scene earlier in the movie when Carol gives him the pager back and she's like, you know, I don't remember what the exact line of dialogue is, but she says something like, this isn't for us, you know, just to chit chat back and forth, like only use this in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And which I'm still not 100% sold on the fact that he wouldn't have used it earlier
right.
in another movie. Like, why did he wait until this? Like, clearly there have, you know, the Chitauri invasion would have been a moment that I might have pushed the button.
Yeah.
Been like, hey, we need some help here.
I think that's why they go to such lengths to have him say that he created the Avenger Initiative so he wouldn't have to call her. And I think he knew how far away she was going to be, too. So, you know, he knew it was a very, very big deal. And, yeah, I mean, that's – you can certainly – quibble with that. I have no problem quibbling with that. I just think that I think they did about as much as you could reasonably do to make it somewhat plausible that he hadn't called her before. But I right, do agree right. that, yeah, in the real world, quote unquote, yeah, he probably would have called her before. So,
but I just the shocker of the scene to me was, you know, I was smiling at seeing the Avengers there and seeing them, you know, at the headquarters trying to work the problem after, you know, the Thanos snap and everything and the conversation about the pager. But the shocker to me was that you see Natasha say, and I want to know who that signal's going to. And then she turns around
and boom, and
Brie Larson standing there.
That's that. Yes. I was just like, oh my gosh, that blew my mind. And here's the thing. She's the same age, right? She's not older. Yeah. So what do we make from that? Is it like time dilation from travel through space? Is it that she's now immortal? Cause she's a walking cosmic cube, an infinity gem. Uh-huh. I mean, yep. And it opens up the whole question of, did it take 20 years to beat the Kree back down into being civilized again or whatever?
Yeah, which is what I think is cool about where they have Captain Marvel as a character, because you can use her in the present day Marvel movies and also have solo movies with her in this period of time between 1995 and now.
Yes.
Different things that she's doing or how she stopped the Kree-Skrull War, or, you know, whatever you want to do with her. I think it's cool that they can use her in both time periods.
And we might yet find out that she got, like, Captain America put in suspended animation in 1997 in the midst of fighting the Supreme Intelligence or something. I mean, we don't know. We have no idea. Yeah. But yeah.
And like you were saying about all the connections that they made with this movie and stuff that's to come later in the MCU. Like, to me, that's always the cool thing about going back and doing a period piece in a shared universe like this, is that it affords you that opportunity to fill in the blanks a little bit more. You know, you've got a little bit of hindsight as a writer and as a producer, and you can say, okay, we want to make this connection now, or we want to answer this question that people have had for so long, and we can use this character to do it.
Yeah, they've really got a lot of room for a Captain Marvel 2. I mean, there's a lot they could do. And it doesn't have to all be in a period piece either. I mean, you can do it like, you could almost do it like Winter Soldier, where you have it set in the present after Endgame, but it can refer back in some flashbacks to what she was doing, kind of like with Bucky, you know.
Right. Oh, exactly. So, and I think it was a good move. You know, the smart thing that they're doing now more often, they're not doing it with every movie, but early on they were killing off all of their villains.
Yeah.
And, you know, very few of the villains survived a movie other than Loki.
Mm-hmm.
And I like, you know, it helps that you're not killing off these really good characters that are played by really great actors. You know, so Yon Rogg's still out there, and you kind of think he's not going to be satisfied with Carol beating the heck out of him and then just sending him back to the Kree. Yeah. With a message, like he's going to want some sort of revenge later on down the road.
Yeah. And that would be cool. And he is Yon Rogg, one of Captain Marvel, at least. I mean, that, the other thing I was going to ask is, did they ever actually call her Captain Marvel at any point in this movie? I know that toward the end they talk about Marvel and Marvel and all that. Then Nick Fury says something about Marvel and she's like, no, it's Marvel. And they never actually say I'm Captain Marvel, right?
No. And I thought, you know, when they did the kind of cute little bit between her and the future little Monica Rambeau, on the porch, future Captain Marvel,
yes,
that we grew up with in the '80s. When they did the bit with the two of them where she had Monica help her come up with a new color scheme for her costume.
I love that.
Which I thought was cute. I thought that would have been the opportunity for her.
Yeah.
Because it would be such a kid thing, mm-hmm, to have called, because she called Monica, what was it, Lieutenant Troublemaker?
Yeah.
Or, like, that was her nickname. Like, I thought, oh, well, that's how she's going to be Captain Marvel.
Captain Marvel, yeah.
Monica's going to do it back the other way.
Right.
And go, well, yeah, if I'm Lieutenant Troublemaker, mm-hmm, then you're Captain Marvel or something. You know, we would have gotten something like that.
Something like that. Did you see that Monica's mother's call sign was Photon?
Yes, which I, cool. I loved.
Yeah, that's really good. Because that's, yeah, for those that don't know, that's what Monica Rambeau, the little girl, I mean, plenty of people probably don't know. When Monica grows up, she's the first female Captain Marvel when Carol's still calling herself Ms. Marvel. And then later changes her name to Photon when another character calls himself Captain Marvel that we're really not going to go into in this episode. That gets us way far afield. We need to do an episode just on the history of the comic book characters and the whole Marvel family.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so it's just a whole other show.
And it's funny because, and I loved seeing Monica in this movie.
Yeah.
As a kid, because, you know, I don't know that you and I have talked about this in detail, but the run of the Avengers comic book where Monica was Captain Marvel and a part of the Avengers in the mid 80s,
right,
was about the time that I became a hardcore Avengers fan. And I've loved that character since then. Mm-hmm. And loved the fact that they included her in the movie. And that means, okay, so now you start doing the math and you're like, okay, so she's going to be an adult in the present day. And, you know, Nick Fury offered her mom a job at S.H.I.E.L.D. So you could kind of sort of see where maybe Monica would grow up and be a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent or be involved with S.H.I.E.L.D. And, you know, there's lots of ways that they could bring her in as an adult into the present day, which would be cool.
And I liked how little Monica had like the big hair like her mom did in the comics originally. Yeah. I thought that was a cute touch.
Yeah.
Because the mom had like the really, you know, pinned down hair, but Monica had like the big foofy like Monica in the comic. I thought that was really cute. Any other things we want to touch on before we wrap up?
I just think they did a phenomenal job of kind of threading the needle.
Yeah.
Of a standalone origin story plus setting up the character for Endgame plus setting up the more cosmic side of the MCU for future Captain Marvel movies. And is Captain Marvel going to be a part of a Guardians of the Galaxy sequel, or, you know, what exactly is the plan for the cosmic side of the MCU moving forward? And I know we talked about it on my show where, you know, we were kind of looking forward to phase four and how we really can't say for certain what they're going to do because they have so many directions they can go. And it's almost too crazy to comprehend, which is why I thought this movie did such a good job of threading that needle so perfectly and, you know, really establishing this character for the future while at the same time giving us a really good standalone movie. You know, I think it's hard to do that sometimes. And, you know, Marvel's had some missteps here and there where they've tried to look too far into the future instead of concentrating on the movie that we're in the moment of. You know, like Iron Man 2 or yeah. Iron Man 3 or Thor the Dark World, where they were setting up and they were seeding things for the future rather than just giving me a good movie now that had some threads that were left over to be picked up in a later movie.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I mean, there's so many questions that you have coming out of this movie that you're excited to see where it goes.
Yeah. And I agree. I think that the main thing it did, it took a character and a set of characters, really. If you include Mar-Vell, Carol Danvers, and whatever name she's going by, Monica Rambeau, the Kree, the Skrulls, Ronan, the Supreme Intelligence, Yon Rogg, Minerva, the Star Force, all those things, Nick Fury, and you put them all together, it did an amazing job. There might have been a couple of things I would have done differently, but I can't complain. I mean, I just think it absolutely checked every box and did everything it needed to do. So,
well, and I think that's, you know, you bring up a good point to kind of close on, because I think that's where we're at with these movies, where as fans who have read the comic books our entire lives and now, you know, we're into year 11, going into year 12 of the MCU, and we've watched all these movies, you know, hundreds of times, and we're really invested in the characters, it's easy for us to say, and especially since we're both writers, this is what we would do. Mm-hmm. And when they don't do what we would do, 9 times out of 10, it would be a disappointment to us. But Marvel seems to hit that 10th time where we watch it and we say, okay, that's not what I would have done, but it's still cool.
Yes.
And I still love it. It's whereas, you know, with a lot of the, and I think this is where my problem with some of the DC movies is, and I've ranted about it on my show, that it's not even that they're not doing what I would do. It's, you know, they're making horrible story choices. And,
yeah,
you know, with a couple of exceptions here and there, like Wonder Woman and Aquaman, and I'd like to think that they've righted the ship over there. But Marvel, like we've said, with except for, you know, a few movies here and there, even though they're not doing it the way I would do it, they're telling a great story, and they're setting the characters up for even more stories down the road. And so I can't complain. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. it's like saying I want a steak for dinner and somebody gives me a steak, but it's not seasoned the way I would want it, but it's seasoned better, or they put a sauce on it that I loved that I wasn't expecting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, I got the steak. It wasn't how I would have done it, but it was better, or it was just as good. So I'm not going to complain.
No, exactly. Exactly right. Well, so I guess we should go ahead and make an appointment, because we'll be back soon talking about Avengers Endgame, and that one we're probably going to need 3 hours to get through.
But it's funny. I was just talking to somebody the other day, and I said, I feel like with you and a couple of other people that I've had on my show to talk about Marvel stuff over the years, I feel like maybe we need to make an appointment to go see Endgame together and then find a room or someplace that we could just immediately go and record our reactions, like literally 5 minutes after we see it.
We probably should. Maybe we could figure something out. We're not that far apart, honestly. I mean, in the grand scheme of things.
We're not, and we have about 4 weeks to plan it. So
yeah, we need to do that. We really do, Jim. We need to do that.
I mean, that's the crazy thing to me is I walked out of the theater yesterday watching this movie, and I thought to myself, holy crap, an Endgame is coming in like 4 weeks.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's
like, we don't have to wait.
No. And we only had to wait a year from the last Avengers movie. I mean, in our day, you had to go 3 years between Star Wars and Empire and Jedi. Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. So, all right, well, we'll wrap things up for today, and we will reconvene in the near future to talk about Avengers Endgame. Thanks a bunch, Jim.
Oh, thank you. I love this.
All right.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
As always, we have to thank the fine folks who keep our programs on the air via Patreon.com. And that can be you. If you enjoy the things you hear on the White Rocket Entertainment Network, such as the White Rocket Podcast, the Avengers Assemble Podcast, the AU Wishbone, the Open Wheel Racing Show, the On Her Majesty's Secret Podcast, of course, our big James Bond show, all of these are part of the White Rocket Network, and they are supported by all of our patrons through Patreon.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can support the show and also get a number of rewards that you can find out about by visiting www.plexico.net, PLEXICO.net, and just click right through the Patreon link, or you can just go to Patreon.com and search for Van Plexico, me. So we have to, as always, thank the folks who are already our patrons and supporters, and that includes Brendan O'Dwyer, Samuel Salvatore, Christopher Burleson, Carl Von Drunker, and Phil Amthor, as well as Winston Boddy, Willie Carden, Susan Trawick, Ben Spooner, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Justin Bean, Steve Trawick, and Richard Stevens. And there's Johnny Caldwell, Reynolds Wolf, Joshua Corbett, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kangian, Catherine England, George Gaston, Will Summerford, John McCune, Tom Anderson, David Evers, Andrew Barber, Timothy Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, Rich Reimer, Jared Albrick, William Glenn Matthews, Joel Beckham, Theodore Gary, Shannon Butson, Taylor, David Hegler, Mickey B., Hugh Anderson, Shane Bailey, Mick Vigicana, Chris Thrash, Logan Chilton, Tony Perry, Alex Nguyen, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, C.T. Wayne, Dave Powell, Donnie Reynolds, Wade Carson, Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Chris Camo, Darren Pyle, Chris Wardam Wade, Jason Albrick, Randall Walker, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Rob Morgan, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Rains, Nicholas Craig, Russell Milling, Matthew Wagstaff, Joey Miller, Mark Squire, Spanky, Brant Rumble, J.W. Rice, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, and our one-time and anonymous donors. Thank you guys so much for helping keep us on the air. Again, for as little as $1 a month, you can certainly give more, and that will help to pay all of our bills and keep us producing all these shows and the other things that White Rocket does. So again, visit www.plexico.net, P-L-E-X-I-C-O.net, or go to patreon.com and just search Van Plexico. And we appreciate everything you do to help us do what we do for you.